Welcome back, everyone, to what is going to be an absolutely massive episode of The Damage Report. I'm John Adirola, and through the course of the next hour, we've got some important topics we're gonna talk about, certainly. I'm gonna be starting off the show in just a little bit, previewing a little bit of what might be Donald Trump's evolving campaign strategy for 2020. Specifically, what parts of the country is he gonna target to try to change up his electoral destiny? Also, he talks about the Hispanic community in almost exactly the way you'd expect he would while trying to be folksy. At the end of the show, we're gonna talk a little bit about some of the recent psychological research that's been done on conservatives in America, and in particular, Trump voters. What is it that's actually driving them? And if things get bad, if they suffer a big electoral loss, how might they respond? We're gonna take a look at what psychology has to say about that. But like I said, lots of big guests. So in just a little bit, we're gonna be joined by progressive activist Jordan Ewell. He's friend of the show. We're gonna be talking about Iran and also Sean Spicer's debut on Dancing with the Stars, which was ridiculous, of course. A little bit after that, Piper Perabo, actress and activist, is gonna join us once again. She was, of course, arrested last year at the Kavanaugh hearing. So she's gonna be talking about the new information that's coming out about Brett Kavanaugh. Then we're also gonna have author Naomi Klein. She has a new book on the climate coming out today. It's now on sale. We're gonna be talking about the climate crisis, climate barbarism, Saudi Arabia, a whole bunch of interesting topics. So it should be fascinating. You're not gonna miss that, but we're gonna jump right into it with Donald Trump's rally. At his rally last night, in addition to the normal sorts of lies and weird, bizarre statements, Donald Trump did perhaps give us a little bit of an insight into how his campaign team is thinking about the 2020 electoral map. Where do they think they can win? Where do they think they now need to win for Donald Trump to be elected again in 2020? So we're gonna have that in just a second. But oddly, it comes up while in New Mexico, he's talking about what he thinks he's doing in terms of the Hispanic community, what they're thinking about him. And it gets just a little bit weird.
And another great friend of mine, somebody that was on CNN and they didn't like him because he was too positive on Trump. Can you believe it? He happens to be Hispanic. He happens to be Hispanic, but I've never quite figured it out because he looks more like a wasp than I do. So I haven't figured that one out. But I'll tell you what, there is nobody that loves this country more or Hispanic more than Steve Cortez. Steve. Thank you, Steve. Nobody loves the Hispanics more. What do you like more, the country or the Hispanics? He says the country, I don't know. I may have to go for the Hispanics, to be honest with you. We got a lot of Hispanics. We love our Hispanics. Get out and vote.
I mean, if I wrote a parody of Donald Trump attempts to appeal to the Hispanic community that has largely not been a fan of him for as long as he's been around, I would come up with something. We got a lot of Hispanics. We love them Hispanics. The country, it's okay, but we love them Hispanics better. And what is it about Cortez? Is it a joke? Is it a compliment to say, I've never really gotten it. He looks more of a wasp than I do. Is that supposed to be folksy? Is it supposed to be charming? Is it supposed to be, in a weird way, self-deprecating? Or I have no honest idea what that is actually about. I would love to talk to Steve Cortez about it because I don't think he knows what any of that was about. But yeah, the idea that this is how you appeal. You have this weird sort of insulting, patronizing, jokey thing with one person who's not actually there to rebut it. We don't even know what his expression was like, but there's no camera on him, so we don't know how he received it. Probably not well, but that will have to be kept in private because if he were to express a single negative thought about Donald Trump, he would of course be thrown under a bus. But it actually gets even a little bit weirder. Let's move on.
It was very interesting because not too long ago, I saw where the Hispanic American, the Hispanics, were up with me in a poll, 17%. And everyone said, how is that? How is that? How is that? 17%. Up by 70%. I won't even tell you what the final number was because they won't believe it. But you're gonna see what the final number. But you know why? Because the Hispanic Americans, they understand they don't want criminals coming across the border. They don't want people taking their jobs. They want to have that security, and they want the wall. They want the wall.
Okay. So those are statements. We can evaluate some of them. First of all, the weird little verbal tics on his. The Hispanic community, Hispanics, or when in the past video he said, we love Hispanic. That's just weird. That is a very weird thing. That's like Trump Tower Taco Bowl weird. In any event, he made a lot of specific claims there that we can, of course, look up. So I was shocked to find out that the Hispanic community was largely supportive of the wall. That's not what I had heard. So I looked it up, and indeed, 16% in a Pew Research poll approved of the wall, 83% disapproved. That's not the impression I got from that Trump speech there. He also made the specific claim that he's up 17 points, up 17%. I'm not going to tell you the final number because they won't believe it. There's a reason they won't believe it, because if that's true, that's really sad. Because I looked it up, and in a Washington Post ABC News poll last week, 25% of Hispanics approve of the job Trump is doing as president, considerably lower than his overall approval rating of 38%, which is itself bad, even worse among that community. A CNN poll showed his approval rating at 29%. So arguably, let's give him the benefit of the doubt. And he's recently gone up by 17%. That means he was at 8. That's not something I would brag about, but he's found a positive spin on it, I guess. It's likely that the spin is his brain spinning around freely inside of his head. He has no idea what's actually going on, and he's just making up numbers. And in fact, 17 is often the number he uses when he makes up poll results. He also said that about the recent special election, said the guy was down 17 points. No one has been able to find a poll where that was actually true, but that's what he comes up with. But anyway, the important part is why he's doing all of these weird jokes. It's because he has a strategy for 2020. He says, we will campaign for every vote, and we will win the great state of New Mexico. The Democrats want to completely annihilate New Mexico's economy. The Democrats will never get the chance because New Mexico will never give them that chance. Okay, so New Mexico is now on the board, perhaps because some of the states that he won very narrow victories in the last election are trending away from him, especially if you have a strong progressive candidate like Bernie Sanders. He's not going to be winning states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, stuff like that. He needs to look elsewhere. And so New Mexico. But that's kind of a desperate strategy, because he lost New Mexico back in 2016 by 8 percentage points, which isn't great. And in 2018, Republicans lost the governor's mansion and a House seat, meaning that literally all of the congressional delegation is now Democrats. So that's hardly the springboard for future electoral gains, but it's actually worse than that, because Trump's approval rating in New Mexico has dropped 34 points since his inauguration, after he lost the state by 8 points. So right now he's 17 points underwater. It is not impossible by any means for Donald Trump to win New Mexico. Crazier things have happened. Crazier things have stood on stage at a rally in New Mexico last night. And with the wrong candidate, perhaps he could put New Mexico in play. But again, this is not to give you any sort of false confidence. Don't get like apathetic. Don't believe that this thing is in the bag. But if that is the strategy, moving to states like New Mexico, where his prospects are dubious at best, especially with performances like you just saw, it gives you an idea of what his campaign team is currently thinking about 2020. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, Jordan Yule is gonna be joining us on the other side.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, you must unlearn what you have learned. And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Over the past 72 hours, Donald Trump has seemed increasingly hot for some sort of military conflict with Iran. And so I understand that I've been considered an alarmist on this issue before. I sort of think America launching into another decades-long conflict in that region of the world would be an absolute disaster. And so we should be on our watch for it. I've been watching everything that he's said. And he had a recent little address from the White House that I found particularly concerning. And joining us now to discuss, progressive activist Jordan Ewell. Welcome back to the show.
John, thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. Let's talk a little bit about one or two of the quotes from his recent talk at the White House. He said, and this is just an amazing section, talking about, he did say, we were attacked, Saudi Arabia was attacked, but then he went on to say, but we would certainly help them. They've been a great ally. They spend $400 billion in our country over the last number of years. $400 billion. That's 1.5 million jobs. It's not, but he says that. And they're not ones that, unlike some countries where they want terms and conditions. They want to say, can we borrow the money at 0% for the next 400 years? No, no. Saudi Arabia pays cash. They've helped us out from the standpoint of jobs and all of the other things, and they've actually helped us. I guess that in theory is not that dissimilar from how many presidents have dealt with our allies. But man, is it out in front.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but this is just like another instance of Trump like clearly being in over his head. Just like the, you know, the bizarre rambling, the incoherent statements. They're common. We see it all the time. I've talked about it with you on this show all the time. But what's really alarming is now he's talking about this in a context of war. And while, you know, other instances, you know, it might be a little bit more innocent. There's a human totality. There's like a cost here. Like we could see innocent lives lost as a result of US intervention. And on that point, I think it's important to remember that during the 2016 campaign, Trump ran as an anti-interventionist. He was the guy that wasn't going to go meddle around in the world's affairs. He wasn't going to hop on these other military conflicts and glom on these other things, or so he said. We learned that wasn't true. But again, it's another instance of him appealing to this far-right populist base, in this case, on an intervention message, but it ended up being a complete and total farce.
Yeah, although I will remind people, and I've tried to do this for a couple of years now, I think that there's so much desperation amongst good-hearted people who want to see an end to our forever wars, that when a candidate like Donald Trump will say, you know, I'm anti-interventionist, a lot of people will be like, yes, finally, thank you, and then miss that. He then goes on to say, oh, we should be bombing the families of terrorists. We should be carpet bombing cities in Syria. I'm the most militaristic person in the world. He literally said that. I think that there's a lot of stuff below the level of taking over the infrastructure of a country that is still very much opposed to the concept of peace. And here, like he says, you know, I'm not looking to get into a new conflict, but sometimes you have to. He said that yesterday, I believe. I'm incredibly worried about that. I'm curious from your point of view, so far this week, you know, what are your feelings about the potential for some sort of conflict with Iran?
John, and on that point, I don't think you'll be surprised to know that Fox has been beating the Iran war drum constantly. We've documented at Media Matters multiple instances of Fox hosts pushing the president, talking directly to the president, calling for a military conflict or escalation with Iran. Trump just seems to be the guy who latches on to the last thing he heard. And unfortunately, as a person and a president who sits around watching Fox News and cable TV almost all day, the last thing he's heard is you know, jingoistic war propaganda from Fox News. So that's his worldview now.
Yeah. So look, at Media Matters, I've been on your site, and you guys have identified one or two instances where the right was a little bit Islamophobic, and so it's always seemed weird to me that they absolutely despise the culture, many of the countries, many of the individuals, including when they're U.S. citizens and in fact members of Congress, and yet when it comes to Saudi Arabia, finding out that we might dispatch tens or hundreds of thousands of soldiers to defend their oil fields, as you said, Fox News is cheering for war. How do they maintain that weird dichotomy?
Well, like you said, I mean, the Islamophobia is a big driver. as we discovered and published in March, Tucker Carlson's comments about people in the Middle East, in that case in Afghanistan and Iraq, calling them semi-literate primitive monkeys. That reflects this kind of general consensus within the militaristic right that the people in the Middle East and our adversaries aren't human. You know, and when you add this layer of a religious difference onto that, I mean, it's so easy to devalue their lives, to write off the hundreds of thousands of people who died in these conflicts as just collateral damage. I think it's just a complete and total indifference to their very real experiences, their very real struggles being on the receiving end of imperialism. And then you just have oil, as you have a commodity that just supersedes everything. It's completely disgusting.
Yeah, that certainly is. With that, though, why don't we turn to a slightly different topic, slightly arguably less important, a little bit lighter, and that would be Sean Spicer. Sean Spicer made his debut on Dancing with the Stars yesterday, and so millions of Americans saw not a disgraced propagandist for a proto-fascist president, but a fun, wild, and crazy guy who wears lime green and he dances to the Spice Girls. What did you think about this first dance performance?
You know, I'm sad to say I didn't watch. I was watching my Cleveland Browns on Monday Night Football. But you know, this Dancing with the Stars has always served this kind of like this whitewashing avenue and this kind of like PR conduit for some of just the worst people in the world. I mean, for instance, Tucker Carlson has gone through there. Rick Perry has gone through there. But the thing that really struck me about his thing is he's already kind of building this Republican grievance narrative. He tweeted out and then deleted after he was widely condemned for it that he was going to ultimately be voted off because he's a Christian, which, you know, doesn't really, I don't think that's a you know, that's not a category on the judge's score sheet, whether or not you're religious or not. But it's just, you know, it's just another example of this right-wing grievance culture, because then that would set him up on a whole nother grift, right? He's then the guy that Hollywood hated because of his faith. And it just perpetuates this complete fabrication that the right loves to latch onto, that conservative religious people are exiled in Hollywood, when really just maybe he's just not a good dancer.
Yeah, it's possible. Look, I would guess that if I ever end up on Dancing with the Stars and the judges turn against me, they give me a 4 or whatever, I'm probably not going to assume it's because they hate atheists. I think that would be low down on the totem pole of what issues they might have with me doing the conga, I would assume.
Exactly.
Also, by the way, if you are trying to set yourself up as like the ultimate Christian who went into this den of wolves and fought for your religious rights in the face of these barbaric anti-Christians, Spice Girls? I guess.
Hey, yeah. I think someone had said that he looked like he was electrocuted the way his arms were moving. It's just the lime, the neon green top didn't really help his image at all. He also looked like that kind of puffy shirt from Seinfeld, if you remember.
Yes,
just
the
optics were yeah, exactly. Like the optics of this whole thing are just really bizarre. In the end, what he may have seen as an avenue back to redemption and public acceptance again is just kind of leading to more mockery, which I'm okay with.
Yeah, and look, I know that to some extent, even this segment where you and I are making fun of him is going to be seen as, some people are going to say, well, come on, he's being a good sport. He's being brave. He's doing something that's obviously he's not well designed for. But that's a part of the con that's going on right now. You don't get to literally defend Hitler behind a podium at the White House and then 2 years later get paid six figures to wear a pirate shirt and all of a sudden we're even. We're not even. He's a terrible guy. And I don't want to see other people from the Trump administration being normalized through the same process.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I don't want to see Sarah Huckabee Sanders on Top Chef.
No, not at all. Padma would not be buying what Sarah Huckabee Sanders would be cooking. Anyway,
absolutely.
Jordan, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break here. We come back. Piper Perabo is going to be joining the show once again to talk about Brett Kavanaugh and new allegations against him. After skating by for more than 6 months with almost no political or media scrutiny for his actions, Brett Kavanaugh is once again this week back in the national conversation. And joining us now to discuss is someone who has long had a vested interest in his position on the SCOTUS, that is actress and activist Piper Perabo. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm good. Not in regards to Brett Kavanaugh, but I'm doing good overall. How are you?
Good. Same.
Awesome. We talked last, right around the time of his confirmation hearings. You had been arrested, dragged out of the hearings. So I'm curious, how do you feel about the scrutiny once again being placed on his record?
I'm happy about it. I think that there wasn't a thorough FBI investigation the first time around, and this is what happens when we don't do our jobs properly, then we have to go back and fix it all. So I'm glad that there are people calling for an investigation and an impeachment inquiry. I think that's the right thing to do.
Yeah. So I mean, we're sort of fast forwarding quite a bit from the last conversation that we had. And I mean, I remember thinking after, you know, the hours of testimony and then Susan Collins' speech, when he got on, I thought, you know what? Please let's hope that this does not simply become normalized, that people right. will pay attention to it. And largely, it seems like that didn't happen. I'm curious, at the time, did you think that by this point there would have been a more serious reckoning for Brett Kavanaugh?
I mean, I was so heartbroken after the Susan Collins speech when she said she would vote to confirm him. And she said in her speech that she thought by voting to confirm him, it would, you know, bring people together and unite the judiciary. And I don't think that's happened. I didn't really know what was going to happen. I feel like we don't have a process in place for this when there are allegations of wrongdoing brought against a judicial nominee, especially in the Supreme Court. And so one of the good things about having an FBI investigation into this, whatever the result, is that maybe we could have some guidelines so that we don't have to do this kind of make it up as we go along version the next time something comes up.
Yeah. And so, look, I know that you've been doing research on the impeachment process, and a number of presidential candidates on the Democratic side now support his impeachment, or at least an investigation that could lead to his impeachment. Now, some people respond to that by saying, might be divisive, similar to when they talk about impeaching Donald Trump, that it could hypothetically hurt the Democrats in 2020. What do you think about that concern?
I disagree with that concern. I think that you don't run a government based on what might happen to a candidate in the future. You stand up for what you believe in. You make sure that we have lawful process and people have confidence in the justice system. And you stand up for values like telling the truth. And when people come forward with allegations of wrongdoing, we trust that our law enforcement agencies will investigate that. Whatever, you know, people say, oh, you don't want to go for impeachment because of Kavanaugh or Trump, because McConnell will never let it come to the floor for a vote. But what McConnell does is up to him. I elected my representatives to be a voice for me in this government, and I think we should investigate allegations of wrongdoing.
Exactly. Yeah, I guess, why people would say, well, if it can't get to where we need it to be, why go along that path at all? But I feel like, first of all, our elected representatives have a constitutional responsibility. They can't right. necessarily assure the outcome, but they can assure the process. And also I worry so much about setting a precedent where if the Republicans, especially thanks to the way the system is set up that benefits them in places like the Senate, that there will just be no consequences whatsoever.
Yeah, and I want to see people on the record. You know, if allegations are found to be factual and we get to a place where we're having a vote for impeachment on the Senate floor, I want everyone's vote to be known. I want you to be on the record for how you're dealing with this and not, you just don't get a pass because we're too afraid to look at the truth.
Yeah. Now, look, as I pointed out in the beginning, you've been involved in this since the very beginning, fighting for scrutiny and perhaps consequences for Brett Kavanaugh. Some on the right, they respond by saying, oh, you guys, you would say that about any nominee. You guys are going to somehow conjure, you know, several dozen women with allegations of sexual assault, no matter who it is. What do you think about that argument that the right is pushing?
I mean, I didn't go in and interrupt the nomination of Gorsuch.
That's a good point.
You know, I had a lot of angry feelings about that because I felt like Merrick Garland was denied his seat on the court and then they bring in Gorsuch. But I wasn't, there weren't women coming forward alleging him of wrongdoings. We weren't happy about it, and that's not the nominee I would have liked. But you didn't see women protesting and people coming forward with allegations of sexual assault.
Yeah, that's a great point. And you would expect that was only a couple of years ago. People should be able to remember that. Not to mention the fact that, of course, George W. Bush got two people on the Supreme Court. The Democrats weren't inventing sexual assaults back then either. But that sort of gets us into, Oh, did you have something you want to say?
I was going to say also, like, when you're talking about people coming forward and victims of sexual assault, I mean, that the default answer is like, oh, you're just doing that for political reasons. Part of this whole like Me Too movement is believing survivors to the point that you at least investigate what they say. No one's saying that someone says something and so you trash somebody's career, but someone brings up an allegation of a crime and you investigate it. That's
exactly
all we're asking for.
Yeah, exactly. And the claims that some of these women are doing it, they're just doing it for self-interested reasons. Yeah, like with hindsight, we can totally say that Christine Blasey Ford, she's really benefited from being dragged through the national media. This has been a big winner for her in terms of publicity and money. I mean, it's just absurd.
I mean, she has nothing to gain, which is obvious from the result. And this woman that Max Steyer, the claims that came out in the New York Times over the weekend that Max Steyer brought up, and the woman who says she doesn't remember, I mean, part of me thinks, of course you don't remember. Why would you say anything about this after what you've seen happen to Christine Blasey Ford?
Yeah, let alone the fact that she might have blocked the memory. That is that's often a thing that happened. That doesn't mean that it didn't happen. But again, an investigation would get to that, but they don't,
exactly.
They don't want that. And so that's the last point that I want to touch on is the arguments that we've seen whenever virtually anyone makes a claim of a sexual assault or sexual harassment against a powerful person. It feels like the right feels very emboldened to simply say, it doesn't matter how many women you have. A woman saying something happened means literally nothing. It counts for nothing. And so what do you think about, if you agree, I don't want to speak for you, but the precedent being set where a woman's testimony is effectively not important?
Well, I mean, that's what's happened with this case. And I just feel like as a woman who's watching my government and my judicial system, part of why I don't like this president is because women have come forward with claims of sexual assault over and over again. And it's starting to feel like it's starting to feel like isn't, you know, extreme, but it feels like our voices don't matter. Our allegations aren't listened to. Our bodies aren't safe. I mean, that's why I stood up. It's really hard to continue to be silent.
Of course.
So, not.
Of course, and especially considering that for any woman, but especially a woman very much in the public eye, to do so means that you will be attacked constantly. I appreciate you doing that, Piper.
Thanks.
And once again, thank you for joining us on the show. Always good to get your commentary.
Thanks for talking about it, John. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you. We're going to take a short break. We come back. Author Naomi Klein is going to be joining us to talk about her new book, The Climate Crisis, and what we can possibly do to fix things. If you want a serious analysis of the threat posed by the climate crisis and what we need to do to address it, it's long been a safe place. You could find that in the writings of Naomi Klein. And starting today, we've got an especially good example of that. The new book, On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal, on sale starting today. And joining us now to discuss, author Naomi Klein. Welcome back to the show.
Happy to be with you.
Happy to have you here, especially on the launch of your most recent book. Very exciting topics I'd like to get into. Can you tell us what differentiates this most recent book from some of your past writings on climate?
Well, it is focused on the need for a Green New Deal, as the subtitle suggests. The first book I wrote about climate change ran close to 600 pages, 70 pages of endnotes. It was a really comprehensive case for why we need a transformative action and how we got to this dangerous place. This book is a lot more accessible, honestly. It's essays that are some of them personal, but also very practical in terms of how to win an argument for a Green New Deal with maybe a resistant relative or friend who's telling you it's too expensive, it's not practical, and so on. It really takes the lead and begins with the student climate strikes, which, you know, we're going to see more examples of in a couple of days, and the kind of existential urgency that young people are bringing to this crisis.
I've been very excited to see throughout the year, there's been a lot of conversation about the Green New Deal, but there's also been a lot of misinformation, not all of it coming from people who are climate deniers. To you, when you hear people talk about the Green New Deal, maybe they talk about their climate proposal, which isn't necessarily actually the Green New Deal, but they like that label. What do you think people need to know about the plan to understand what it should actually be to accomplish its goals?
Right. Well, I think, first of all, it's important that it be guided by the best science, right? In the resolution put forward by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey, it begins with the science and the report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that told us a year ago that we had 12 years to cut global emissions in half. So anybody who says they have a Green New Deal or any kind of climate plan, we have to be very clear that they actually have a plan to meet those targets, right? And they also have mechanisms to keep themselves honest, right? To make sure that they don't blow our carbon budget. But what really sets the Green New Deal apart is that it puts economic justice, racial justice at the center, right? So it's not only about lowering emissions in line with science, it's also about battling poverty and economic exclusion, including historical exclusions that were very much reflected in the original New Deal. So, I think in some ways what we need to be looking at is who has a real story of transformation, right? It is not just a collection of policies. We're talking about mapping the next economy.
Exactly. You alluded to the fact that there are these different proposals, and certainly, amongst the Democratic primary contenders, there's quite a few climate proposals. Are there any that stand out to you as being grounded in the best science that seem to take the Green New Deal most seriously?
Well, look, I think that that Warren and Sanders have the most ambitious plans. Warren took a lot of her climate plan from Governor Inslee, who ran on a very bold climate platform, and there was a lot of input into that plan from climate justice organizers in Washington State and across the country. Bernie Sanders' plan is more ambitious, just in terms of the money on the table. It's significantly greater than what Warren is talking about. But I think for me, even more importantly, what is critical about the Sanders plan, and I do think this is something that Warren needs to be pushed on, has to do with a more internationalist focus when it comes to the Sanders plan. He's talking about putting $200 billion into the UN Climate Fund so that it really recognizes that the US cannot lead on this just by example. The US is the world's largest historical emitter, and that means that we actually owe a debt to the countries on the front lines of climate impacts who did the least to create the crisis. And we aren't going to get where we need to go unless we're willing to help poorer countries keep carbon in the ground by leapfrogging to clean tech, to renewable energy, and also helping them deal with the impacts of climate change that are already upon them. And I think if the U.S. does not live up to its duties under different UN climate conventions, then it's not going to be taken seriously as a leader, and it isn't going to have that catalyzing effect. So I think that's pretty important. There's also different approaches to the military that are really critical. I think Bernie's been the one who has most forcefully made the connections between military conflict and climate change, the fact that so many of the wars that we fight are in oil-rich regions, and that's not by happenstance. Mm-hmm. Whereas Warren is talking a lot more about sort of greening the military. So these are some sharp differences that I think people need to pay attention to.
Well, and I think this week is a great example of that difference. I mean, there is a possibility that we could launch some sort of attack against Iran to defend Saudi oil facilities, which is almost perfectly an example of something that you talk about quite often in terms of climate.
Yeah, and I mean, these issues are so interrelated, and it's one of the things that I find frustrating watching the Democratic primaries. I agree with Sunrise 100% that we needed a climate debate, an official climate debate, where all of the top candidates are on stage together, and we're able to really contrast their climate plans. But in the absence of that, we also need candidates who talk about the Green New Deal, no matter what question they're asked. I mean, I think we're still very much in this paradigm where you talk about climate change when you're asked about climate change, as opposed to really weaving it organically into your whole economic program. Because if we really are drawing inspiration from FDR's original New Deal, that was not a singular job creation program. It was his framework for governing for a decade. And that is what we need in the face of the climate crisis if we are indeed going to transform our energy system in the very short timeline that we have. We know that we need to, radically change where we get our energy, how we live in cities. It's impacting housing, agriculture, transportation, all of it, right? So you don't need to be asked about climate change to talk about your plan for getting to a zero carbon economy.
There's a term you've been using recently that I'd love for you to talk about for our audience, and that is climate barbarism. Can you tell us what that's about?
Right. So I guess I would just say that we've spent a lot of time focusing over the years on the fact that on the right side of the political spectrum, there is a lot of denying of the science of climate change, and that is certainly true. But I think what we're starting to see is that the only thing more frightening than a sort of unhinged right-wing racist movement that denies the scientific reality of climate change is an unhinged far-right racist movement that no longer denies the reality of climate change and starts using the climate crisis as a rationale for waging war on immigrants, fortressing borders, and as a justification for why it is okay to allow huge swaths of humanity to die where they are. And this is what we are starting to see at the fringe of the fringe with the El Paso killer who went to Walmart and said he was basically going to hunt immigrants because they can't have the American way of life. I mean, he said, we know that not everybody can have our way of life. So he went to Walmart to kill immigrants because of that. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And he was taking inspiration from a mass murderer in New Zealand who went to two mosques on March 15th. And that killer identified himself as an ethno-nationalist, eco-fascist. Once again, in his manifesto, he talked about his environmental concerns, and he saw immigration as an environmental threat to the white Christian world. So we are already starting to see this absolutely toxic intersection of fears of economic of ecological breakdown, resource scarcity, and white supremacy mixing together to create what I'm calling climate barbarism.
And I think a great example of that sort of process, and an example, by the way, that the damage that's going to be done by climate change is not something that's 20 years away or 50 years away. We're experiencing it right now. I don't know if you saw the report that something like 7 million climate refugees had been motivated to move just through the course of this year so far.
Yeah, I did see that in the first 6 months of 2019, 7 million people have already been displaced. We're seeing it in real time in the Bahamas. Hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans and also reportedly were forced to leave the island. In every case, it isn't one simple driver, right? I mean, in the case of Puerto Rico, you have this toxic intersection of the legacy of colonialism, decades of economic austerity intersecting with heavy weather linked to the climate crisis that creates this complete system failure, and people feel forced to leave their homes, and then come up against these governments like the Trump administration who are using the fact that their base knows whether or not they claim to deny climate change or not. They know that we are in a period of mass migration, that it isn't going to end. And they're using people's fears of the other, of this sort of this feeling of a sort of an imminent invasion to build their political project. And so this is why, when we think about the urgency of a Green New Deal, we're not just fighting for a habitable planet, we're fighting for our humanity on a habitable planet. Because we are at this fork in the roads where we have to decide, given that the climate shocks are already upon us, are we going to hoard, fortress, lock out, leave to drown, or are we going to reckon with the fact that this is that we live in an interdependent, interconnected world, and we have to find a way to share our remaining resources inside our countries and between our countries, which is why, as I said, I think it is so important to talk about what are our international responsibilities in the face of the climate crisis, not only our national responsibilities.
The book, which I can't wait to read, is out today. It's On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. Naomi Klein, as always, thank you for joining us on The Damage Report.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You too. We're going to take a short break here. We come back, one more topic to close out the show. You might find yourself wondering from time to time, what are Trump supporters thinking? Well, it turns out psychologists have been wondering that as well. And they've done quite a bit of research, some of it specifically on Trump supporters, some of it on right-wing American political thought, some of it on how people become conservative in the first place. And I think that some of this research, just a brief overview, would be very helpful in understanding both the current situation we're in and also how strong Trump supporters might react if things go badly for them, if their candidate were to lose a presidential election. For instance, I want to give credit, by the way, to Chaucy DeVega of Salon for collecting some of these. We're going to attempt to fill out the list with little tidbits of psychological research. Let's jump right into it with why people have this sort of MAGA-styled backlash. Okay, so backlash is triggered because ideal and material structures of the status quo have been abruptly displaced, and those who occupy those structures wish to return to the time before displacement, when they were sitting and standing in what was obviously, and not just in retrospect, a better place. Now, for different groups, in different times, in different political contexts, that better place could mean different things. It could mean a better economic place. It could mean a racial hierarchy where you were sitting at the top. I'm not saying which the Trump supporters are thinking about, but maybe it's one of those things. And it can lead to some negative thinking, some even chaotic thinking. I want to turn now to some interesting research about the need for chaos in politics. Researchers asked a number of subjects if they agreed with the following statements. One was, I fantasize about a natural disaster wiping out most of humanity such that a small group of people can start all over, the sort of scenario that's in a lot of teen sci-fi novels. I think society should be burned to the ground. Sometimes I just feel like destroying beautiful things. There is no right and wrong in the world. So some of those are sort of anti-establishment ways of thinking, but some of them are just amoral, the entire thing can just be blown to bits Alderaan style, and I would be perfectly fine with that. Well, in this survey, nearly 1 in 4 respondents, 24%, agreed that society should be burned to the ground. 40% said, when it comes to our political and social institutions, I cannot help thinking, just let them all burn. Now, there are some productive things that that could lead to, hypothetically. There's also some incredibly unproductive, drain the swampy style, shallow invocations of that way of thinking that is really just a desire to see things sort of be shaken up in a negative way that isn't necessarily mollified by suddenly your group being in power. You still want that feel of chaos in politics. And it's a weird combination, those two things. We know also that people who endorse authority and strong leaders and do not mind inequality, the two basic dimensions underlying right-wing political ideology, show lower levels of emotional abilities. That is research you can read, Van Hile and his associates. It's also something you can experience yourself by going on Twitter, literally any day you can find that. Beyond that, we know that other research shows that Trump supporters and other conservatives are likely to exhibit what psychologists call the dark triad of human behavior. That's Machiavellianism, psychopathy, and narcissism. Now, again, this sort of research, especially in a context like this, where I'm just doing some broad brush, giving you an idea of what's out there that you can do more research in, does not mean that every Trump supporter is Machiavellian or a psychopath or a narcissist or whatever. Sure, Trump is. But it is more common. It's not to say that people who don't like Trump can't have those traits. Of course they can. But there is a pretty strong trend that has been identified in a number of different pieces of research. And what's especially interesting is when you talk to Trump supporters about what they get out of being a Trump supporter, especially in its most purified form, and that is attending a Trump rally. Some of them have been interviewed and they said things like, once you start going, it's kind of like an addiction, honestly. I love the energy. I wouldn't stand in line for 26 hours to see any rock band. He's the only person I would do this for, and I'll be here as many times as I can. And can you really blame them? To be surrounded by 10, 15, 20,000 people who are all chanting the same thing as you, who all think exactly like you, who all hate the same people as you. That can get you high if you're a certain type of person. And if you're not a certain type of person, it's on you to know what this is about, to do the research, to be prepared for what happens if things get even worse in America. Okay, thank you so much for joining us throughout today. It was obviously a big show, but a lot of fun as well. We got big things planned for the rest of the week, so we'll see you then. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Arola. I'll see you soon.